There we go. There we go.
He's Ben Stanley.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Hey, everybody, it's Kyle Risdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and this is Make Me Smart, our weekly podcast about tech and the economy and some culture and some things that we feel like talking about depending on the day, where none of us is as smart as all of us. If you are a longtime listener to this podcast, you know that, generally speaking, politics are not our thing. But in this case, we're making a bit of an exception. I know at this point you're freaking out and you think we're going to talk about impeachment.
Oh my God,
and we're
please,
not.
No, not again.
We're totally not. Nope. We are not that program. But there is this thing that we want to get smarter about that has reappeared in the news and that, frankly, I personally had a lot of questions about. And today is one of those days.
And it's a story that's been in the news on and off for 100 years. We are talking about the Equal Rights Amendment. You might have seen in the news last week, Virginia ratified it. The Equal Rights Amendment would make it unconstitutional to treat men and women differently under the law in this country. Now, there are those of you out there who might believe that the Constitution already has language like that, a clause or rule that says explicitly you have to treat men and women equally. But that would be wrong.
Right. That would not actually be the case. And I think for a lot of, certainly speaking for myself, when I saw this news pop up out of Virginia that the amendment had been ratified and that was the 3/4 of the states needed to put it in the Constitution, I was like, wait, what? Really? Is this a thing? But 80% of people, according to some polls, think that women's rights are constitutionally protected, which may or may not be accurate, which we'll get into in our upcoming interview. But so women and some men, yes, have been fighting to add this very specific language to the Constitution since the 1920s. And right now, the only thing that's specifically constitutionally protected with respect to women is the right to vote. Mm-hmm. And women basically said, hey, that's not enough.
But history being what it is, you know, that was the 70s when it really got going and got a lot of momentum. But times change. Pendulum swing. And it has languished and lingered there for a very long time until last week when Virginia became the 38th state to ratify what would be the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. But you're not noticing any celebrations because there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on with this particular amendment that we're going to talk to our guest about. Her name is Julie Sook. She is a professor of sociology and political science at the City University of New York. Her book on the topic we're going to talk about is called We the Women, the Forgotten Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment. Julie, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So let me ask you about that celebration question, because Virginia passed it and one would imagine, okay, we're done, right? It's the law and it's the Constitution. And what happened?
So Virginia voted to ratify last week, but I believe the ratification doesn't become official until there's a pro forma crossover vote. So that's next week. And I think we will see some celebrations then. But you are asking a much larger question about the legal uncertainty of the Equal Rights Amendment. That is, there will be celebrations because there's some disagreement about whether or not the 38th ratification is enough to add it to the U.S. Constitution. And the reason there's a question about that is that when Congress adopted the ERA in 1972, they asked the states to ratify the amendment within 7 years. And by the time 1977 rolled around, there were only 35 states, and you need 38 to have an amendment. So then Congress extended the deadline. They extended it to 1982, but no additional state ratified between 1977 and 1982. And then in 1982, some of the opponents of the ERA had their celebration and pronounced the ERA dead. And so for decades, there were a few attempts in Congress to reintroduce the amendment and start all over again. Those didn't really get off the ground. But then in 2017, Nevada decided to continue ratifying the amendment that we thought was dead in 1982. So Nevada ratified in 2017, Illinois ratified in 2018, and Virginia voted to ratify last week.
Huh. So it's at least politically revived, but now you also have these five states, Idaho, Kentucky, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Tennessee, who are saying, well, we would like to rescind our ratification. A, can they do that? And B, how in play is this amendment right now?
So as for the states that purported to rescind their ratifications, that happened in the 1970s. And historically, states have attempted to rescind their ratifications of amendments before. The 14th Amendment is an example. There were two states that attempted to rescind their ratifications of the 14th Amendment, which was passed after the Civil War, to guarantee the equal protection of the laws. to people who were formerly enslaved in this country. And Congress did not recognize those rescissions then. So there's really no precedent for congressional recognition of rescissions. The Constitution doesn't really say anything about rescissions, and it's long been understood that it's really up to Congress to decide whether any rescissions are valid.
What about the issue of the time limits and the 7 years that Congress wrote into the original ERA? How problematic is that?
Well, they didn't actually write it into the ERA, and that's something that's very interesting, because when they first invented time limits on ratification, they wrote it into the Prohibition Amendment, the 18th Amendment. So if you open up your pocket constitution to the Prohibition Amendment, you'll see that the time limit is there. It says, shall be inoperative unless ratified within 7 years by 3/4 of the states. But with the ERA and with some other amendments later in the 20th century, Congress didn't put it into the text of the ERA itself. They put it into the resolving clause, that is, the language introducing the amendment that got sent to the states for ratification. So I think because of that difference, many people believe that it's up to Congress to change the deadline when there are good reasons to do so. And Congress actually did change the deadline once already in 1978. They extended it to 1982. And that's why Congress can now remove the deadline. And there's a bill that's been reported out to the floor of the House that would do just that.
For the non-lawyers among us, can you explain the whole resolving clause thing?
Mm-hmm. So when you have a constitutional amendment, there's the stuff that's going to get added to your constitution and will appear in your pocket constitution.
Yeah.
And then there's other language that says, be it resolved. And there might be language just explaining some things, but they don't actually become part of the constitutional text. They just kind of lay out, you know, we're doing this now. And so it's sort of been understood that that's not really part of what's being ratified by the states when they vote on ratification of a constitutional amendment. And because that's not what's being ratified, Congress can change what's in that resolving clause.
This is fascinating. This is like the most episode we've ever had. I am learning so much about how, you know, the social studies part of this. But let's move from the social studies part of this to the controversy part of this. You brought up the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. And it seems like critics say that that is enough and that that text does, in fact, say that, you know, no state can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Why isn't that enough?
So the Equal Protection Clause was never read to prohibit sex discrimination until 1971 in a landmark case that was litigated by now Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg called Reed versus Reed. The timing of that switch in the Supreme Court's view of sex discrimination is not a coincidence. The ERA was making its way through Congress, and it's only because the ERA was drawing attention to the need to ban sex discrimination as a constitutional matter that we started getting jurisprudence interpreting the 14th Amendment to prohibit sex discrimination. So it's really a question of giving credit where credit is due. The ERA was doing all this work even without being formally added to the Constitution. And in 1973, in a case called Frontiero versus Richardson, some of the justices actually cited the ERA. They said the ERA is evidence that Congress is interested in scrutinizing sex distinctions in the law. And so as a matter of constitutional law, the Supreme Court really started moving in a direction toward sex equality only because the ERA was in the political hopper.
Okay, so, it's going to sound like I'm trying to be really woke here, but I'm not. It is, to me, self-evident that there is a need for an equal rights amendment to the Constitution as we sit here in 2020. Could you lay out for me, though, the arguments that opponents of the ERA made, specifically women who were opposed to the ERA back in the mid-70s, and how that whole conversation went?
Well, there is a long history of women being opposed to the ERA, dating back to when it was first introduced in 1923. And in 1923, when the ERA was introduced, the Supreme Court was in a place in our history where it had been striking down labor protections for workers generally. But there was precedent at the time that said that there could be labor protections for women only because they were mothers. And because of their role in childbearing and child rearing, you could have minimum wage laws that were for women only or maximum hour laws that were for women only. And so when the ERA was introduced in 1923, a lot of the social reformers who had worked hard to get those labor protections for women were worried that the ERA would mean that those special protections for women would have to be struck down. And so these were really feminists.
Oh, interesting. They thought it would be too equal.
Yeah. Then in the 1970s, you got a different version of a similar concern. So Phyllis Schlafly and the Stop ERA movement, which really gets off the ground in 1972, just as Congress adopts the amendment. And they really get their arguments from some of the male senators who were opposed to the ERA on the floor of the Senate. But the argument is that if the ERA is going to treat men and women the same under all circumstances, it might lead to some unintended consequences where women are going to be disadvantaged. And that argument against the ERA was actually based on a false understanding of what the ERA would actually do. The proponents of the amendment did not believe that the law should always treat men and women the same under all circumstances. They just believed that the Constitution should lead to a scrutiny of differences in treatment to ensure that any differences in treatment were justified rather than based on gender stereotypes that had no place in modern American society.
So were it to pass now, what kinds of things would be affected? You know, here in 2020, what kinds of things would this amendment actually potentially change?
Well, one of the most interesting features of the ERA is Section 3, which almost nobody talks about. And Section 3 says that the ERA doesn't actually go into effect for 2 years after the date of ratification. And that was baked into the amendment on purpose to give state legislatures and Congress and government actors generally an opportunity to revisit many of the laws that they have on the books. Laws that might distinguish between men and women that don't really make much sense, or laws that actually disadvantage women, and to make changes to those laws and decide whether to protect more people and just to make better policy. And I think that is something that you're going to see happening and is already happening because of the political momentum behind women's rights that has itself fueled the ERA movement today. So that's one thing. I think as a matter of law, like law with a capital L, there are some precedents under the 14th Amendment jurisprudence, even though it does now prohibit many forms of sex discrimination. In the 1970s, the Supreme Court said that the Equal Protection Clause does not prohibit pregnancy discrimination. And if you look at the legislative record of the ERA, the proponents of the ERA in the 1970s were very concerned about all the ways in which women were disadvantaged because of their role in childbearing and child rearing. And so given that legislative history, I think it's much clearer that the ERA would prohibit pregnancy discrimination than the Equal Protection Clause does. The other thing that happened in 2000 was that the Supreme Court struck down a very important part of the Violence Against Women Act. That was a law that allowed victims of gender-motivated violence to sue their perpetrators in federal court. And the Supreme Court said that Congress's power to enforce equal protection did not reach the power to regulate gender-motivated violence by private actors. I think this is also something where gender-motivated violence is something that's much more directly connected to equal rights without abridgment on account of sex than it's connected to the concerns of the 14th Amendment. So that's something I think that could change as a result of the ERA.
How does this eventually get resolved? Because once Virginia formally does this, there are the 38, and we've talked about people states rescinding, how that's not really cool. And the time limit thing clearly is open to interpretation. Congress has indicated, many members of Congress have indicated that they're willing to extend whatever that time limit was in the prefatory language. What now? What?
Right. What's next?
So Congress can extend the deadline. And I think there is a political process by which that'll work itself out. I think the House is probably going to vote to extend that deadline very soon. It's harder to predict whether the Senate will also vote to extend that deadline in this legislative session. There are some people who believe that the deadline is inappropriate and possibly unconstitutional. And to be fair, the precedents that support Congress's authority to impose a deadline on ratification of constitutional amendments date to the Prohibition era and applied specifically to the Prohibition Amendment, which, as I mentioned earlier, actually put the deadline in the text of the Constitution itself. That said, I think it's clear from another precedent that the Supreme Court has always taken the view that whether there's a deadline or not is really a political question that's up to Congress. So given that that's true, and given that almost every amendment that has been added to the U.S. Constitution in the 20th century did have a 7-year deadline, whether it was in the constitutional text or in the resolving clause, I think that it really is up to Congress to remove the deadline in order to make it certain that the amendment is fully legitimate in the eyes of the American people.
I can already hear Kai say something about Congress and its backside, so I'm going to just assume
Let's give the full quote. The full quote assumed. Is that the Congress of the United States right now can't find its backside with both hands. It really can't. Sorry. Anyway.
So setting aside the odds of Congress acting, I guess it seems to me that what you're saying is that the ERA, despite not ever becoming enshrined so far, has still been and may continue to be actually a sort of looming force for change, that the mere existence, the possibility of it becoming a constitutional amendment could itself drive change to state laws. Is that a fair assessment? And do you think that'll continue to happen?
That's exactly right. And I don't think we should underestimate the importance of that. That is, I don't think we should be sitting around acting glum about the fact that we have 38 states. We should be celebrating the fact that we have 38 states, notwithstanding what's going to happen with the deadline. And here's why. Before we had 38 states, when we just had 2/3 of Congress having voted on the ERA, that was enough for courts to really start paying attention to sex discrimination and changing the way they understood the 14th Amendment. And now we're at the next milestone. The next milestone, after 2/3 of both houses of Congress adopting it, is 38 states ratifying it. And we're basically there. And once we've gotten to that milestone, that is a strong political signal to state legislatures to pass laws that promote real equality for women in the United States. And that includes laws like the Pregnant Worker Fairness Act, laws that would really address the sources of unequal pay, laws that would try to address the underrepresentation of women on corporate boards or other leadership positions. There are so many public policies that I think can do something to eradicate remaining gender inequality. And that's something that the political force of 38 ratifications would give legitimacy to.
Julie Sook, thanks so much. Her book, we should say, on this topic, coming out in June, is called We the Women, the Forgotten Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment. Julie, thanks a lot. Really, really totally fascinating stuff.
Yeah, thank you. We are smarter.
Thank you.
That was great. That was great. I could talk con law all day, but I'm really glad I didn't go to law school. I should probably say that.
This is the moment where I'm always torn. Like, is it too late? Maybe I should go back.
Really?
I do have those moments.
Oh, man.
All right. Fantastic. One of our producers, Erica, asked a question just as we were wrapping that I think we should explore in the newsletter, actually, which is, you know, whether how many states do have some version of their own, of their own equal rights amendment within their state constitutions. And
do we think any? Not to be glum, but do we think any?
I mean, I got to assume some do have something, right? You think California has nothing? I don't know. We'll find out.
State constitutions are really interesting, right? Because we're all reasonably familiar with the U.S. Constitution and, you know, the format and article whatever and, you know, all that, you know, we the people of the United States. But state constitutions are just a different beast.
I mean, right?
Oh, now here, Erica's, all right, I'm going to live Slack this. Erica says, fine, don't ask my question. And then she says, they do. And then she says, I know a little bit about this. So I guess we'll see.
See? This is why she writes a newsletter. Okay, so tune in or sign up for the newsletter to find out. The Make Me Smart newsletter. What is it? Marketplace.org/newsletter? Sign up?
I don't know. Somebody knows.
I always read it in the promo.
But also, send us your thoughts. What you think about this? The whole ERA thing. Do we need one? Do we not? Is it going to work out? Is it not? I think actually the whole, because there's going to be some kind of court fight about this. You got to figure there will be.
It is right? Just the idea of it as sort of this looming force too. It feels a little bit like parenting. Like I not to make it a mom thing, but I was having this metaphor in my mind of like, this is how I parent. Like, well, you better get in line or it's going to get a lot worse. Just saying.
Okay, mom, please don't kill me.
Make me smart at marketplace.org for your thoughts. I learned so much from that. I loved it.
All right, now we're going to go.
We'll be back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
We are back. It's time for the news. Molly's got two, otherwise known as Tuesday.
It's either none or it's two. And I just, in this case, it's two.
Okay.
Guys, okay. I know that we keep talking about all these other things. And like sometimes on this show, we'll say things like, what's it going to take to get everybody on the same page and start getting along about things? And I always say aliens. Oh, yeah. And that is one option. But the other option is like global virus outbreak. How are we not only talking about how there's like a whole new virus that no one has ever heard of and experts say it can be transmitted by humans? Okay, I am freaking out about this.
Okay. Spend 30 seconds and tell people what you're freaking out about, because not everybody is as tuned into the news as perhaps we are.
I know, totally.
Okay. So
which is part of the, everybody should be talking about this. Okay. All right. I'm going to calm down. There is apparently a never before seen virus. It is a version of something called a coronavirus that has killed 6 people, infected nearly 300 people in China so far. There are confirmed cases in Taiwan, Thailand, Japan, and South Korea. Recently, experts said that this disease can apparently be transmitted human to human, which is, of course, very scary, because what they thought initially was this might be like an animal-borne or a food-borne virus that people hadn't seen. But in fact, human to human. And I heard this morning that there are even concerns that it's being transmitted in medical facilities, which means that even people who are like wearing gloves and masks might still be contracting this disease. So it's all new. All these airports in the United States are screening passengers who are coming from some of these countries. And this is like, guys, this is the horror scenario. Global pandemic. Just saying.
Okay.
I don't even have anything to say about it, except that this is my zombie apocalypse nightmare come to life. Like, we don't, it's such a thing that we don't even think about anymore. Like, what if there's a brand new virus?
Okay.
That's all I got. Okay. I'm scared about it. I'm scared, and I need a hug.
If I were there and if we're professionally appropriate, I would give you a hug, but I'm not.
I feel like it wouldn't be, so you know. I feel like Kai would actually pull a Cher from whatever that movie is. He'd like slap me across the face and be like, snap out of it.
Well, I tend to be less worried about these things than you do, and that's, you know, that's fair. Oh. Everybody's got their own thing.
You know, as long as we're live Slacking, I would just like to point out that Erica Phillips just remarked in our Make Me Smart Slack that Tony Wagner just got a New York Times alert that the first U.S. case has been reported.
Okay.
Mark my words, people. It's The Walking Dead. I am in no way trying to make light of this. It's just, I'm freaking out.
Okay. What else you got?
And then when I think to myself, how are we going to deal with this? Should it become a really big deal? And then I fear that we are just so mired in partisan politics that we won't even be able to amass an effective response to something like major, like a viral outbreak.
Yes.
One weird thing that happens to me in these times where it's only politics on the news is that I get the Hamilton song in my head, the one last time when George Washington is stepping down. Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorites.
With a decent respect and for there's the just that. Of mankind. Yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
I mean, it's beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Time. Yeah.
And then there's the, I know, it's been a long time since we had a Hamilton sing-along. But he says, when he's talking about how he wants to step down and he wants to write, that one of the things he wants to write about is partisan fighting. He says, I want to warn about partisan fighting, right? So Washington, you know, wrote about this all the time. He said it was a huge danger to democracy. And in fact, he said the greatest danger would be because of the chaos of dysfunctional democracy and that it would, you know, basically lead to authoritarianism. And I found this great quote actually when I was reading about it in Politico because he was very influenced by this writer, Joseph Addison, who also talked about a furious party spirit. And he said, it exerts itself in civil war and bloodshed. It fills a nation with spleen and rancor and extinguishes all the seeds of good nature, compassion, and humanity. And it basically, it's just so, it's very relevant right now. It's like its own kind of virus.
Oh, nicely done. Very nicely done.
I didn't even write that down. That just happened.
That was kind of genius right there.
I'm pretty proud of myself right now.
That was kind of genius right there. You should be. You should be. That was excellent. That was excellent.
Thanks, man. All right, your turn.
I'm going to pass. I mean, I got something. But I'm going to pass. Mine is pedestrian and rote and more blah, blah, blah from Kai about the economy and who cares. You did a nice little arc there and we're gonna end on that one.
All right. Thanks, man. But we all care. That's why we listen to Marketplace.
It was a beaut.
Scary times.
It is in a lot of ways, scary times. But you know what's not scary? What's not scary is hearing me and Molly come out of your Echo device when you say, Alexa, make me smart. That is not scary. That is enlightening. It is fun. It is quick. It is a little tidbit of information. I will speak like a grown man. to help you get on with your day. So all you have to do is say, make me smart, and you'll hear the latest.
It is true. My son, by the way, calls that hella voice crack.
Yeah, it happens to me all the time.
Yep.
It's been happening since I was like 15.
And apparently so are you. Yeah.
Also. Never mind.
Also not scary, the fact that we have such a smart community of listeners. I mean, I know that things are not all scary, and I'm not trying to be all dark place today. So let's let you guys talk for a minute because you are so smart.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, let's hit it.
All right. Last week's episode, we talked about fake news and how disinformation impacts our elections. Abigail from my home state of Montana wrote in and said, hey, Kai and Molly, I just listened to your podcast on Cambridge Analytica. I was struck by your suggestion that kids should be taught about cyber knowledge and security in schools, which I absolutely agree with. I'm happy to share our daughter's elementary school librarian is already doing some teaching on this. Thank God. She writes, she began learning about cybersecurity and what data to be aware of sharing starting in first grade. I am hopeful that data literacy will also be taught, although we will certainly be having those conversations at home too. That is awesome news, Abigail.
So do they do it in your kid's school? Do you know?
I don't think so, no. But a lot of people wrote and said that it is happening. And so I was actually really kind of heartened by that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reasonably sure the mic at school doesn't do it. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We got, like I said, a ton of comments about this. A listener named Dexter Fry wrote in to tell us about the News Literacy Project, which is a nonprofit, apparently, that has a goal of teaching digital literacy to 3 million high school and middle school students by 2022. Rajiv Ramanath wrote in to tell us about the SURE campaign, S-U-R-E, an initiative from the National Library Board to promote the importance of information searching and discernment. Like, it does seem to be happening. There are people out there, this is well-crafted, doing the Lord's work when it comes to digital literacy.
It's real.
I was heartened. A lot of people said it's happening. Yep.
Okay. Now, the not hurting part. You talked about last week negativity bias and how negative ads are so effective because there's a biological, actual biological reaction that happens when we see or hear something negative in the news. So Ashish Jasani did a little research on that. It's about to make you smarter, and all of us actually. Here you go.
Hi, Molly and Kai, and everyone else at Make Me Smart.
Yeah, buddy.
I found Molly's news fix about negativity bias interesting. So I decided to do a little research about how the body responds to positive and negative stimuli as a system. Simply put, our bodies produce dopamine in response to positive stimuli and cortisol in response to negative stimuli. Well, it turns out that the half-life of cortisol is about 60 minutes, while the half-life of dopamine is only about 2 minutes. That means the body metabolizes dopamine 30 times faster than cortisol. Basically, our bodies experience a negative emotion to some degree for almost 30 times longer. I found this really interesting and thought that it correlated well to the greater effect a negative experience has versus a positive one. Thanks, guys, for making me smarter.
Oh, my God. We literally stew. That is insane. We got to fix this. I'm sorry, but if, like, CRISPR is good for anything, it should be for this.
Oh, yeah, because there we go. That's what we're going to do with gene editing. We're going to do that.
Many a scary sci-fi movie has begun with the premise. Like, that's what the whole Serenity series is about, the premise that we tried to engineer out Discord. I think that's what The Matrix is about, too. And then The Matrix is all about the negativity bias, because remember they tried to make everybody happy all the time, and they were like, all those simulations failed.
I never saw
it. Because humans just are not.
I never saw it.
Well, I'm sorry, what?
I never saw The Matrix.
Kai never saw The Matrix.
God, you're killing me.
I'm going to need to say that louder.
I was going to slide it in there. I never saw it.
My stomach hurts. You need to have a movie night at your house on Friday.
All y'all come on over. Later. We're doing movies at my house.
Later than Friday.
Okay, all right.
It's on Netflix.
Just because it's on Netflix doesn't mean... whatever.
I'm just saying it's not even hard to watch now. It's just like...
All right.
You got to watch The Matrix. Right. It is everything right now.
Okay. All right. I guess I will.
Wow. We've learned so much. and now we are done learning, because I'm going to predict that this is going to be the greatest answer to the Make Me Smart question that we may ever get. We're changing things up a little bit with the Make Me Smart question, because there's a time to be smart and there's a time for this. What is something you once thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Take it away, Josh.
I used to think mayonnaise was gross. Now I know that I was wrong. Mayonnaise isn't gross. It's delicious.
RIP our mentions. That's all I have to say, man. That's all I have to say. Because that was going to light people up. Right?
It really is.
It is. It is totally, you know, we
like
talked
nothing.
The Constitution. We talked negativity bias. Yeah. We talked DNA and dopamine. And what's going to light people up on this one is mayonnaise.
Yeah, it's going to be all mayonnaise all the time. Here it comes.
Yes, we're waiting.
On that note, let's end.
Let us. Please.
Please don't forget to sign up for our weekly Make Me Smart newsletter, which is going to have so much awesome information about state constitutions and also the Matrix this week. It lands in your inbox every Friday morning with all manner of goodies from the week's news and culture. Check it out. And that's it.
That's it. We're done.
Yep. We're going now.
We're leaving.
We're just running away from the mayo storm, headed our way.
Wait, where are you
Make
on mayonnaise?
Make me smart.
Wait, where are you on mayonnaise?
Pro. I'm pro mayonnaise.
Me too. Me too.
Never Miracle Whip.
Yeah.
Only
God,
blue kind.
No. Oh, Jesus, no.
Hellman's.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Make Me Smart is produced also on burgers. I think, what makes a cheeseburger delicious? Mayonnaise.
You bet. How do you feel about mayonnaise on grilled cheese sandwiches, using that instead of butter to grill cheese?
That's okay, but it can get a little overly tangy.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Yeah, it can happen. Yeah. It can happen.
Okay.
All right. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson, who is doing his best right now, probably making hand signals in the behind the glass. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. And our senior producer is Jody Becker, and they're going to have to parse all the Mayo feedback.
Yes.
Thank you to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, and our new video intern, Ethan Peretz. And thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips. Oh, look at that.
Daniel Ramirez, engineer of the program, started the music a little soon, though. That's all I'm saying. We ran out. Theme music was composed by Ben and Daniel Ramirez. Ben Talladay, rather. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Senior vice president and general manager, Deb Clark, ran out of music. I don't know what else to do.
Just keep talking. Just keep talking.
There we go.
We're done.
We don't know how anybody of those people feel about mayonnaise, though. That's...
Erica is anti-mayo.
Seriously?
Jesus is pro-sriracha. I'm happy with sriracha and mayo together.
No! What?
What? Oh, yeah. Anything. I mean, that's the beauty of mayonnaise. It can be the base for any good thing. You can mix other things in there. You got a little aioli situation happening. Mm-hmm. Spicy mayo, garlicky mayo.
Yeah, curry mayonnaise. I get that. Sriracha mayo? No. I'm just saying.
I've never tried it, but I'm going to tonight.
Ew.
I bought a bunch of lump crab. Maybe we could have sandwiches. Okay, sorry. Please continue.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.